Morning. Merry Christmas. There's so many more of you than there were when we started. It just never ceases to amaze me. But you're welcome anytime. I'm glad you're here. This is the final Sunday of Advent, which is our season of preparation for Christmas. So we've been preparing in this church this year by looking at the five women who are named specifically in Matthew's genealogy for Jesus. You know, it was always important in the Bible who your ancestors were. And it was especially important for the Messiah because, according to prophecy, he had to be descended from Abraham and David, had to be the house of David. So Matthew gave us this long list of men that led to Jesus, but along the way he named five women. The fifth will finish tomorrow night with Mary, and I hope you'll be here. But today we're still focused on the Old Testament women. I wore my Old Testament coat of many colors. These two women extended the line to King David and beyond him, Ruth and Bathsheba, two of the best known stories in the Bible. There's been endless speculation about both of them. And I guess the best short stories are the ones that can be interpreted many different ways. Ruth eventually became David's great-grandmother, but we meet her as a young widow. The story actually starts with a couple living in Bethlehem, Elimelech and Naomi, and their two boys. There was a famine in Judah, which is southern Israel, so they moved to Moab on the other side of the Dead Sea. I used to think there was a lot of famine in the Bible days, and maybe there was, but I also learned it's a literary device. Whenever you need to move a group of people from one place to another, there was a famine. And I've come to really like that. I like the symbolism that they leave a place where they are going hungry and literally seek a place that will nourish them. That's what we do spiritually. That's why a lot of us are here, to be fed. There was a famine somewhere else, so we moved. So this little family moved from Judah to Moab, even though the Moabites were despised by the Jews, and Moabite women were considered loose. Elimelech died, leaving his wife Naomi. The boys grew up and married local girls, Moabite girls. And within about 10 years, the sons had died too. Naomi, meanwhile, heard that the famine had ended in Judah, so she decided to go home to Bethlehem. Her sons had left these two young widows, Ruth and Orpah, O-R-P-A-H. Now, Oprah Winfrey's mother intended to use that name and got it wrong. And I just think the Orpah show would never have worked. So you can see divine method in everything. So we have these three widows, Naomi, Ruth, and Orpah. And you know how badly women fared in those days if they didn't have some man in the family to care for them, a father, a husband, sons. Naomi was going back to Bethlehem and told Ruth and Orpah there's no point in staying with her. They should just go back to their own families. They still had time to marry again. And Orpah sadly did go back, but Ruth wouldn't go. She loved her mother-in-law. And this is when she delivered those beautiful lines. Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Did you know those lines were said between two women? There is some speculation that this story was written by a woman because it is about women who outsmart the patriarchy, which is the kind of story that women tended to tell. It's about getting their needs met and making a man think it's his idea. It is. I'm sorry. So, Naomi and Ruth arrive in Bethlehem. They're very poor. And in those days, the poor were allowed to glean grain behind the harvesters. They could walk behind the people who were harvesting and just pick out the leftovers. It was a form of welfare. So Ruth went out to glean, get them a little food, and she said to Naomi as she left, "Hey, maybe I'll catch the eye of some man." Sure enough, she was spotted by the landowner, Boaz. He gave her water. He gave her extra grain. He told the hired hands not to harass her. She was really grateful, especially because she was a foreigner. When she went back and told Naomi, Naomi said, "You know what? Boaz is actually a distant relative of this family. Now, remember last week, the levirate marriage law? When a woman's husband dies, another man in the family is supposed to take care of her and give her children. Ideally, it will be a brother, but any male relative next in line will do." So Naomi had an idea. She knew that Boaz would be sleeping in the barn on the threshing floor to finish off the harvest and protect it. So she said to Ruth, "Dress real pretty and then go lie down next to Boaz in the barn." Boaz indeed was there that night. He had been eating and drinking, and the Bible says his heart was merry. So he crashed to sleep, and Ruth came in about midnight. Boaz kind of stirred and asked who it was. It was pitch dark, and she explained she was Ruth. They had met earlier, and what do you know? Turns out he's her next of kin, and Boaz was glad to hear it. So they spent the night on the threshing floor together. The Bible is not specific about what happened, and Ruth slipped out before dawn. Just call me Angel of the Morning. So Boaz knew. Unfortunately, there was another kinsman who was actually ahead of him in the line, and he did the right thing. He went to the kinsman, gathered a lot of witnesses, and asked the kinsman if he wanted Ruth, and the man said, "Nah, you take her." So they got married. Boaz and Ruth got married, had a baby, Obed, and Naomi, the mother-in-law, was very happy. And the story actually ends with Naomi caring for that baby. Ruth disappears from history at this point, but the line continues through Obed to David, the most important king Israel ever had. So what do we make of Ruth as an ancestor of Jesus? Last week we had Tamar, who tricked her father-in-law to get the child she wanted, and Rahab, a prostitute in Jericho, who helped Joshua conquer the promised land if he would spare her family. These are the women specified in Jesus' lineage, kind of shady, not necessarily the most upstanding moral women. Maybe Ruth was a seductress of Boaz. Maybe she was just resourceful, taking care of herself. Maybe she was bravely enforcing the levirate marriage law, God's law, claiming her right to marriage and children, or maybe she was just young and beautiful and lucky. The story of Ruth at the time, though, had another important message. It's okay to accept some foreigners among the Hebrews. Some of the foreigners are good people. Ruth was a Moabite, but she not only married two Jewish men, her line led to David and eventually the Messiah. So they were relaxing their tribal insularity by this point in Hebrew history. Well, a few generations passed, David is born. David, you've seen the statue. He was the handsome young shepherd chosen to be king. He killed the giant Goliath with his slingshot. He played the harp to soothe the crazy King Saul. He was a mighty military leader. He had wives and concubines and children. We've known David for a long time, before the day when he was walking on the terrace of the palace at sunset one evening, and he looked down and spied a beautiful woman taking a bath outdoors, Bathsheba. This was a ritual purification that women did every month. We don't know whether Bathsheba knew that she could be seen from the palace. Maybe it was a setup from the beginning. But David thought it was his idea. So he asked who she was, and his aide said, "Oh, she's the wife of Uriah the Hittite." No, David knew Uriah. Uriah was one of his best warriors. In fact, he was away in battle. It was spring. David actually should have been in battle with his men, and for some reason, he'd just been hanging around the palace. He just couldn't get into it that year. But he saw Bathsheba and he sent for her. He was the king, of course, so he could not be refused. And she visited him for a while. She went home and not long after sent word that she was pregnant. David started scheming. It's not the crime, it's always the cover-up that gets you in trouble. So David starts a cover-up. He calls Uriah back from the front, assuming Uriah will sleep with his wife, and then everybody will just assume the baby was Uriah's and no harm, no foul. But Uriah wouldn't do it. While his unit was out sleeping on the ground and fighting for God and truth and justice, this was a tradition among soldiers at the time. David tried twice to send him home. He even got him drunk one night. But Uriah wouldn't leave the palace and go see Bathsheba. So David sent him back to the battle with a note for General Joab that said, "Set Uriah in the forefront of the hardest fighting and then draw back from him so that he may be struck down and die." Uriah didn't know he was carrying his own death warrant. He gave the note to the general. David was the king. He couldn't be refused. So the general abandoned Uriah on the battlefield and he was killed. It was a really despicable thing for David to do. When Bathsheba had finished her official period of mourning, and we have no idea how she felt about any of this, David brought her to the palace and added her to his harem. She always was a favorite wife, but the word love is never used in the Bible in describing their story. Well, word kind of got out what David had done with Uriah. We don't know whether Bathsheba ever knew about it or how she felt about it, but God was unhappy with David. So he sent the prophet Nathan to rebuke him. Nathan, I think, was played by Edward G. Robinson in the movie. So this little guy, you know, mean little guy. He told David a story. Once upon a time, there was a poor man who had a little lamb, a ewe. He had bought her as a baby, brought her up. She was a pet for his children, this little lamb. She ate table scraps and drank from the man's cup and slept with him at night. She was just like another child. The rich man next door was entertaining a guest, and he didn't want to kill one of his own flock. So he stole the poor man's lamb, his only possession, and slaughtered the lamb for dinner. David, the former shepherd, reacted to this story exactly the way Nathan knew he would. He was outraged. He said, "That rich man deserves to die." And Nathan said, "You are that man." Just as an interesting side note, that parable of the lamb survived and is included in the Quran of Islam. The part about David's adultery and murder, not in the Quran. The Hebrew version, interestingly enough, is the one that makes King David look so bad. So the version we have in the Old Testament, this story is defining for David. Nathan said, "You are the man." And David got it instantly, and he was mortified. He realized what an awful thing he had done. He repented and he cried. And Nathan the prophet said God would forgive David and would not smite him. But the child that had already been born to David and Bathsheba would die. And within a week, he did. On the surface, this is a story that says God punishes sin. Not just the sin of taking Bathsheba, but the sin of having Uriah killed. David was the rock star king of Israel. But his name was never again mentioned without a reminder that he had Uriah killed. So what does this story tell us if it's not about a God in the sky that's watching and punishing sin? Maybe it was an attempt to explain why bad things happen. A child has died, maybe the parents did something wrong. Or maybe it's about karma. There has to be a balancing of accounts. Or maybe it's about principle. We live under spiritual laws, and if we run afoul of them, things go awry. And the primary law is, what you put out into the universe comes back to you. Well, David had been dealing death, and that's what came back to him. He and Bathsheba actually had three more children, including Solomon, who succeeded David as king. Solomon's the one who built the spectacular temple in Jerusalem. Solomon was not the oldest of David's sons, but Bathsheba schemed with the prophet Nathan to get Solomon in line for the throne when David was old and sick and confused. She turned out to be a steel magnolia. And it's another story of a woman bending the rules to get her way, to take care of herself and her family. All four of these stories are about that: Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, and Bathsheba. So again, why do we have these imperfect women leading in the line to Jesus? One lesson we said last week is that you don't have to be perfect to be used for divine purposes. Thank goodness. And the further lesson is that each of us is divine, made in the image and likeness of God. If God is all there is, what else could we be? In unity, we call the divine within the Christ, which is different from Jesus the man. The Christ is our spirit, our essence, our divine core. And we celebrate Christmas as a reminder that each of us was born with that Christ spirit within, just as Jesus was. But what good are these ancient stories about people long gone? How does it help us get through the week or make Christmas more meaningful? Well, chances are you'll be spending Christmas with some imperfect people. And they are divine too. They were born with the Christ spirit too. Granted, sometimes personality really messes it up. But it's still there, the Christ spirit that's born in each of us. So when you're opening your presents or eating together, look for the Christ in them. Because this is how we experience God on earth. And I believe this is how we get closer to the divine, by looking for the divine, seeing it all around us. I'm not saying you have to be buddies with every person, but acknowledge your oneness with them and appreciate the Christ light shining through them, especially if their behavior is questionable. Our lives today have just as much moral ambiguity as these stories in the Old Testament. We can't be sure whether people are doing the right thing. Ruth seems to have been pretty sweet, but Bathsheba? If she were in your family, don't you think there'd be a lot of gossip around the Christmas tree? We tell all these stories all these centuries later because we know how they turned out. We know that their decisions were crucial in the unfolding of world history. What if the same is true for those lugheads around you? What if the decisions they're making, or the person they grow up to be, is part of a bigger picture that changes the world, just as the birth of Jesus changed the world all those centuries later? What if the flawed people around you are being used for divine purposes? We experience God through other people. So look for the light of the divine in those around you and feel the love in you that is divine and unconditional. The Christ is born in every child. Mary is the fifth of Jesus' five mothers. She represents that nurturing protector that allows the Christ consciousness to gestate and be brought forth. And Mary's in us too. She was willing to be used for divine purposes. So we'll talk about that tomorrow night, and then we will light candles that represent the divine light each of us is shining on this earth. So let's take these thoughts into meditation with Kit.
Let's just breathe. If you haven't yet closed your eyes, you might just want to look around at the light. Flickering candle flames and twinkling lights in the garland and on the tree. And if you look a little further into some of the other things, there's light reflecting off of the ceiling and maybe off the metal of a chair. And shadows on the wall. And focus on that place inside of you that you know. That spark. That light. Has its place. An eternal flame. And as you go within to look at your own light, begin to remind yourself that in this season of light, in this new season, in this new age, and that we have just passed the equinox where the light will now return. Bring to mind those near you, or those who will be near you. Whether physically or just in your heart. And now bring to mind someone that perhaps you have shut out of your heart. Someone you may feel apprehensive about seeing over the holidays. And focus on the light in your heart. And then begin to pass that light on and out to that other person or those other people. And then bring to mind that they do indeed have their own light. That they are indeed doing their best to find it, to shine it, to share it. And that perhaps in a moment that light, their light, is simply something that you have not yet been able to see. But stay present in your light. Continue to reach out with your light. And continue to breathe into that space between the light and know that they are one and the same. Yours, ours, mine, his, hers. It is one light. It is one life. It is one heart. And just hold it in your hand. Hold it in your heart. Hold it in your mind. And allow that to carry you and them from this moment and into the next and beyond and beyond and beyond. So breathe now. Let it out. And with that gratitude and that light in your heart and in your voice, please join me for the Alleluia.
Hallelujah.